So hello, Swannies, and welcome back to Keep Honking, the Vietnam Swans podcast. It has been a while, but we've made the wait worthwhile with today's guest. So before I get to him, as always, my co-host is Rod Rocket White. This time he's not in the Taipei studio, though. Whereabouts in the world are you coming to us from today, Rocket?
Farm, Bill. I'm on the farm, surrounded by 65 acres of land and 30 head of cattle. So in the middle of the Tri Valley in Gippsland, a long way from Taipei, snuck through the quarantine barrier at Melbourne Airport, avoided all that sort of jargon, but it was quite quick. And now down on the farm, mate, enjoying some fresh air with the family.
Dare I say it, retired and moved to the farm.
Actually, before you go on, Bill, before you go on, I must say, I know this isn't a visual podcast, but for Christ's sake, man, put a shirt on. You're starting to scare our guest and myself.
Yeah, I'd rather put a shirt over the camera. It's pretty hot in the spare room here. So we do what we've got to do. Now, our guest. This is episode 16 of the podcast. And funnily enough, episode 15 was the first time ever that we had a guest who played AFL footy at the highest level. Coincidentally, somewhat, today we go back to back with another AFL player who I'm sure, just like Ricky was, will bring some incredible stories to the table. Our guest is Matty Francis, who played 55 games in the AFL, playing three of those on Anzac Day for Collingwood, probably the biggest home and away game of the year, not probably, definitely. And post-footy became the Brisbane Lions skills coach. But in reality, his biggest AFL claim to fame is being the brother of Vietnam Swans Hall of Famer, Mickey Francis. So our guest today, obviously, none other than Matty Francis, who is now based here in sunny Ho Chi Minh City. Thanks for joining us, Matty. How are you going today?
Billy, thanks for having me, mate. I'm great. Thank you. It's wonderful to join you and the great man, Rocket, from the farm in Gippsland. It's nice to be with you, gents.
Now, Matty, what we do is, as I said, we've got a few, well, we're potentially getting a few rabbit holes here, but we sort of start with a basic premise of you growing up and local footy, but, you know, where did you grow up? And more importantly, what was the rivalry like with you and Mickey?
Mate, I was very fortunate. I had a lovely childhood and lovely upbringing. We were off a farm outside of Ballarat, a couple of thousand acres, specialising in lamb. And we had barley crops along with many, many other things. But we had the most massive backyard where we had the great cricket games and the great footy games. And I have a twin brother and a younger brother. You know, Mickey's a little bit of an institution over here. I'm Mick's brother. Wherever I go, we used to have there was three of us. So Michael was about 3 years younger than my twin brother and I, so he was a bit of a stepladder there for many years. But I remember fondly most of my after coming home from school. It used to take us a long time to get home. We catch the bus, and it used to be just about dark by the time we got home. But we would kick the footy in the backyard until Mum called us in for dinner. And every single one of those nights out in the backyard, I was always with Mickey. We'd be playing until the stars came up, and they were fond memories, and it was a great lifestyle, healthy lifestyle.
Yeah.
And I heard you mention there you sort of catch the bus home. So academically, were you sort of a clever student at this point in time, or were you sort of a bit of a rogue?
No, I was your A-grade student. I studied on the bus on the way home.
You were a nerd. Okay.
Yeah, I was one of the nerds. I bought it the last couple of years just to fit the sport and the music and everything and the study in. To just take a bit of the pressure off on the travel. So I was very fortunate. I had a lovely upbringing. Went to St. Pat's College in Ballarat, a big footy school, probably the number one footy school in Australia. Even in my time, we used to have the big rivalry against Assumption College, and we used to play in what was called the Herald Sun Shield, and we used to always go down to Melbourne and take on the big boys in Melbourne and do quite well. So we had a successful football team at our school and played first 11 cricket as well. So
was your old man any good at sport?
My old man was a rugby union player. So he went to Xavier College in Melbourne and played rugby union and held him. I think he made a state team in rugby union, but he never played AFL football. My grandfather on my mum's side was a fantastic footballer. I think he might have paid for the Fitzroy reserves there at one stage. So we had a little bit of sporting genetics.
Yep.
So Matty, you mentioned that the footy or the sports and music, did you say, started to sort of get in the way of the academic pursuits. At what stage did footy start to look like it was actually a serious pathway?
You know, when you're growing up, and I'm pretty sure this is the same feeling every young kid in Australia has. When I was growing up, playing footy in the backyard until the stars came out, we're off a farm. Our next door neighbours were probably 6 or 7 kilometres away. But I can remember just from the age of about 7 to the age of 17, just hoping that Kevin Sheedy would fly over in a plane and see me putting all my skills together in the backyard. And you dream of playing, being spotted and playing AFL football. But there was something different. I got a twin brother who was also a good footballer. And we played for a pretty successful local country football team. And we went through the under 12s and the 14s and the under 17s. And we always made grand finals. And, you know, I would always maybe win best and fairest by a couple of votes. And my brother would come second. And we had other strong players, centre backs and rucks, who would always, you know, I'd just pick them in best and fairest counts and all that sort of stuff. But we had a pretty strong, healthy team. And I wasn't a standout at it of any stretch of the imagination. But just to answer your question, I always knew I was going to play AFL football. I always knew it. I just believed it. It was just in my blood. And if we talk a little bit further about the journey into AFL, I even knew what year I was going to make my debut. I just knew I was going to finish year 12, have a year to consolidate. And then I just, for whatever reason, it was just in my bones. I knew I was going to play the year when I was 19 years of age. I just knew I was going to play AFL football. And when I did, I was only 76 kilos and I was 6'5" and I was just long and skinny. I just knew it.
Wow. So you were drafted in 1988 and made your debut in 1990. So one question before we get too far into the actual footy stuff, this is still a little bit more of the perception of a gun sort of kid football player in those days. 1990 was actually the year the VFL rebranded as the AFL. So the league, you know, tried to move into a far more professional state. For you as someone in the system, did it already feel like a sustainable career path, or was it, did you know going in that this is going to be my job, or was it something that I'm doing this for the glory regardless? What was the stage of the league at that time? And obviously, since then, it's come on in leaps and bounds.
Sure. Well, when I got drafted, I went into university as well. So I was lucky enough to do 7 years of university while I was playing football. It was a good combination. So when I got drafted, they put me up in accommodation, and they paid for my university fees, and they gave me some spending money so I could get around. And there was a nice network of other boys all from the bush who all got drafted the same year, and we all sort of lived together, and some were doing university. Some were still looking at just doing part-time little jobs in amongst it all. But it was probably 1994 where it all became semi-professional, where everyone didn't have to work anymore. But between 1989 and 1994, I was a full-time university student. So it was just perfect timing for me. And then when I finished my degree, I was a full-time footballer and earning pretty good money. So that's how it sort of developed in that time.
When you say good money, what was the sort of money like back then?
So in the mid-90s, the average wage would have been about $125,000.
Okay.
It was maybe $200,000. Now it would be maybe $300,000 or $400,000, the average wage. I'm not sure. Maybe a bit more.
Yeah. And then in 19, well, I'm not sure whether well, I'm going to ask it anyway, but you said that 1988 drafted, 1990 made your debut. So 1989, what happened?
So when you get drafted in, when I got drafted, there was still the under 19s reserves and seniors. It was still the pathway. So under 19s were still, so everybody who got drafted usually started off in the under 19s because you're 18 years old, you come into the city and you play, and the whole program was facilitated. And it was the days where you still had the odd game as an under 19 before the reserves at the MCG, and then the seniors would play thereafter. It was absolutely a terrific competition. And, you know, there's still talk today that they might bring an under 18 club level back to the AFL, but I think it's a great pathway. So then what would happen is some days you would get picked for the under 19s, and then if you showed potential, you can get picked for the reserves if you're showing a few good signs. The year before I got drafted, Matty Knights was drafted at Richmond, and he was one of those players who only played one or two games in the under 19s, and then he went straight into the seniors as a young kid. So it did happen, but not very often. That the young kids would go straight into the seniors. Even Wayne Carey and these guys, they played under 1940 the year before I did, and then they went into the senior ranks after that. And that was the same program I did. So, well, I was lucky enough in 1989, we played Geelong in a prelim final and came a draw. So that our prelim final was replayed on grand final day at the MCG in 1989 grand final, the famous grand final, Hawthorn and Geelong, where Dipper got his ribs broken and Dermot Brereton went back with the flight and Ablett kicked all those goals. Well, we played in the prelude game against Geelong that day, and we won by a point in the replay of our prelim final. And then the reserves beat Geelong's reserves, got done by 5 points, and then their seniors got done by 6 points all in the same day. They had three teams all get done by less than a goal. But then we had to play our grand final in the under-19s at that stage against Dennis Pagan's undefeated North Melbourne team, or they might have only got beaten once or twice, and they flogged us by 80 points in the second semi. And we went into that game. We basically played on grand final day. They missed out on grand final day. They had to play in front of like 5,000 people in Waverley for the grand final. We flogged them. So we won a premiership in that under 19 year, which was 1989. And then I had seniors maybe round 7 the year after.
Any of those blokes in your under 19 team that you play with, are they any of them kick along and have sort of long careers post the under 19s?
Stewie Maxfield, captain Sydney Swans, Chrissy Nash, but he plays seniors. He didn't play in our grand final team, but he got drafted. He was Richmond's first selection. I was Richmond's second selection in the 1988 draft in November.
Yeah.
There was a bloke by the name of Steve Ryan, who played a few games. Ty Esler played a couple of games. He's down from your way in Gippsland.
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
I think he got dropped for the grand final, big Ty. And then maybe I'm missing somebody. Ash Prescott played.
There's a few
players who managed to kick on a little bit. But
now, the irony here, mate, is that we're sort of coming off the back of the AFL National Draft, so last week. Mm. And obviously you being a guy that has gone through that experience and being drafted at number 19 for the yellow and black, the famous Tiger Army, as they call them. I'm really curious to know back then, like I think you and I have spoken before about my sort of very, 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 very brief interaction with the AFL back in 1990 at Collingwood. But how did they scout you? Like back then, you know, and obviously when you get drafted, it's like, well, I can't get you on the mobile phone because probably no mobile phone, I don't think, in 1988. So the coach rolls up, the recruiter rolls up, they call the landline and say, we've just picked you up. How did that all happen?
Well, I'll go back a couple of years. Under 15 schoolboy competition, I made the emergencies. I didn't make the team. And that was probably the first selection when they start to identify talent. But even though I only made an emergency, I felt like they were just guessing who should be in the team and who shouldn't be as 15-year-olds. So we've got family in Melbourne. So I just got mum and dad to take me to Melbourne, and I just took my footy gear. And I wasn't invited or anything. I wasn't in the team, but I just rocked up on the boundary line and I had my bag in the car. The guys who picked the team and who were coaching the team at that stage just saw me there and they said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Listen, I've just come down to watch. I've got my bag." And anyway, because I went to the effort and I took the time to just say, "Yeah, I'm here," they gave me a game and I kicked 2.25 goals. And then they played me every game thereafter. And I just stayed with my auntie and uncle. But one of the guys who was on the, who was managing that team was a name by the name Paul Armstrong, Armour. And he was, he ended up going to the Bulldogs and going on. What that did was he then recognised I could play a bit. And then in the under 17s, you get picked for your Teal Cup. This was the next secondary, but I didn't get selected for my area in the Teal Cup. For whatever reason, you just get overlooked. Yeah. And he was surprised. He goes, "No, I didn't even get selected to come to training or anything like that. But I was still playing good footy for my local club. I was still playing good footy for St. Pat's." And then we were playing Assumption College that year, and I played really well for our school and the talent scouts there. But what put me on the map was this thing called the Sun Shield or the Shell Series. And you had the Brian Royal squad and the Timmy Watson. So I was part of this Timmy Watson squad, which was a team from Bacchus Marsh to Dimboola. And I made that team. And then we played against all the other teams and I made the All-Stars team. And then from there, every single club, I was at boarding school at St. Pat's and every single club took the effort to drive up to Ballarat and sit with me at boarding school and tell me all about their footy clubs. There was only, I think, two clubs that didn't contact me. Every other club was on their list. And then Richmond was super keen. They were keen and drafted me with their second pick. And it was a home phone call. So I was sitting at home. We were at exams, doing exams, year 12 exams at the time. And so I was just studying for exams. And the CEO of Richmond at the time, Cameron Schwab, rings me up and says, "You're a Tiger." I said, "Beautiful."
Yeah. And who did you follow at the time? Who were you? Who did you
back? I was a Bomber. I was an Essendon. I love Kevin Sheedy and Neil Danaher, Terry Danaher.
Yeah. I guess you dropped that pretty much and rolled through the doors of Tigerland.
Of course, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So then that step moves into you arrive at the Tigers. Mm. So you're rolling in there and the likes of, and again, some people listening to this will know and some won't know, but some of these players are pretty iconic in terms of Michael Disco Roach and David Cloak and the Fleedale Waitman. And then more recently, you know, Matty Knights, who've been coaching, and Brendan Gale, so who's currently president of the Richmond Footy Club. So really, you know, first impressions when you roll in there in terms of the club and who impressed you, who didn't impress you, who made an impact. Can you sort of reflect on anything around that sort of really stood out, some good and some bad maybe?
Well, it was just such a lovely club. There was no, at the time, I think Roachie and Cloakie and Flea in general were all finishing their careers.
Yeah.
And I just remember, you know, Cloakie just, when I ran out for my first game, he just put me under his wing as we ran through the banner. He's such a big man. He just says, "Just suck it in, breathe it in, enjoy every second of it. You only get this opportunity once." And Dale Waitman was just the most magnificent human being, you know, just such a clever player, such a lovely leader, such a nice, but he had diabetes and, you know, he would be shooting with his insulin and stuff before games and after games, and you could see his discipline. Michael Roach was a superstar. You know, these guys were just wonderful to come into a football club. And then Jeff Hogg and Tony Free and Craig Lambert, and these boys, Alan McKellar at the time, big colourful characters. We didn't have a lot of success, but we had a wonderful, wonderful culture of young boys all just working hard together. And we had Kevin Bartlett was just a phenomenal coach. He was a personality, a charismatic coach. He didn't have a lot of football IQ in terms of tactics and stuff at that time, but he was able to just bring the best out of everybody. And that's why when he got the sack, he had such a young group of players and he was getting the best out of them and he knew it. He as a coach, people were playing for him, and the generation before his generation, the Roaches and the Fleas and these guys had all just retired. And he had this young list that he was just knitting together. And that's why he felt so let down by the football club, because they basically looked him in the eye and said, "Listen, let's just get some games into these guys and go on this journey." And he was so, He was a wonderful performer for the media. He was a wonderful speaker. He was a wonderful orator. He put his heart and soul into it. And I really think if they had persisted with him, he would have had a great career as a coach. But they didn't. And they, Alan Jeans, Graham Richmond was on his deathbed and he just grabbed Alan Jeans. He says, "Listen, grab these young blokes and guidance, Yabby." And Yabby came to our footy club, which was still phenomenal. What a great opportunity to have Yabby Jeans coaches. He only coaches for 1 year and he was, you know, he only did it for Graham Richmond. These are the old days where, you know, old true blue loyal blokes would look each other in the eye and commit to each other and not let each other down. And that's what happened with Alan Jeans. And then John Northey took over from Alan Jeans, and John Northey, he left off with a similar type of philosophy to Kevin Bartlett, and that was just being able to get a young group of boys all playing together. And he was fabulous. He was fabulous for me because what he did was he just kept the same team in and out each week. Regardless if you played well or poorly, he would just back you in. And every unfortunately, I got injured a lot, but every time my body was right, John Northey would stick me on a half forward flank, tell me what to do in terms of who to work with, Jeff Hoggett full forward and Benny Gale at centre forward, and we would just work as a tall triangle. And he was just wonderful, and he got the best out of us. We made a prelim final in 1995. Unfortunately, my whole career at Richmond was just disappointing because my body just couldn't hold up to the rigors of AFL footy. So for the 7 years I was there at Richmond, you know, I played some great footy, but I broke down a lot and missed 4 years of the 7 years just with injury, just on the sideline. So the shoulder reconstructions, 6 groin operations, wow. And then and the unlucky type of injuries where, you know, I just got poked in both my eyes and my eyeballs split and I had to go to the eye hospital and get my eyeballs stitched up. Yeah, and
really?
Just compartment syndrome and hernias and, so I was 76 kilos. I was long and skinny, and they played me on a wing and a half-forward flank, and I loved every second of it. And Richmond was a great club. From the supporters, the coterie groups, the players, everything about that footy club is just outstanding. And then I used to play. I played a few games against St Kilda. Danny Frawley lined up on centre-back. I was centre-forward with him one day. I just come back from a couple of shoulder recos. He grabs me in a headlock, swings me onto the ground and says, "Which shoulder is it? I'm going to fucking whack you." And I just said, "Whichever shoulder you like, mate. No problems. I've got you covered." And then I went and kicked a few goals on him. but I think that game, he retired. He went to Collingwood as an assistant coach. We went to the same school. His brother coached me at St. Pat's. I think he had a little bit of respect for me. And then he traded me from... he was influential with Collingwood trading me from Richmond to Collingwood. And Richmond, they wanted to try something different. I'd been there 7 years and I played 19 games. So it was a win-win. And I got traded to Collingwood in 1995, at the end of 1995. Richmond had just made a prelim final at that stage. So 19 games in 7 years. And then I went to Collingwood.
That's unbelievable. Only 19 games in 7 years, mate. Jeez, that's rough. That is a tough 7 years.
Yeah. So then I think it went something like 8 games, then 7 games, and then 0, then 2, then 0, then 4, or whatever it might have been.
Yeah.
Just couldn't get a run at it, but that's okay. That's life.
Wow.
So in those patches where you were up and about, what was it that you noticed at the AFL level when Spud Frawley didn't have you in a headlock swinging around in circles? But what did you notice from the lower levels coming up to the top level? What changed? What were the biggest challenges? How did you find... Rockets insisted that I ask, how did you find the free drink cards getting thrown around off the field? and who were some of the more impressive players that you came across? You mentioned a lot of the teammates, but also on the other side.
Yeah. Well, it was just about consolidating yourself in your own team for me. It was about getting the respect of your teammates. And then it didn't matter. You were never overawed who you came up against. So one weekend I'd be playing on Gary Ayres. So I'd be half 40, be half back, or I'd be on Guy McKenna the week later, or then... you know, I get shifted back to centre back for a period of time and be on Stephen Kernaghan, or you'd be on Paul Ruse. You know, so I had a great game. One game was in a, we played in a pre-season game, and I was played on Gary Lyon. And, you know when you just get in the zone and you start taking marks and you start anticipating and you just start dominating. And Gary Lyon kicked a goal and gave it to me or something, just got in my face. And the trainer came up to give him a drink of water, and I just grabbed the water bottle off him and squirted him in the face. And I was like, age, and he was the captain of Melbourne. And but you know, you just you're not intimidated by anybody when you get out there. Obviously, you get shown up too, because you know I played a game on Paul Ruse, and I've never come across anybody who's so strong in the arms and the air. And you know, I would just give every ounce of energy to punch his arms, and he was like a rock. You know, these guys were just outstanding players. And they were outstanding because they were special. And they were special because they trained harder than anybody else. They were gifted, and they put it all together. And these guys were super professional. These guys knew how to get their bodies right, even though it was the early 90s. And yes, well, we're at this time when Flea and Roachie and these guys all retired, we didn't have any married guys at the footy club. So every Monday night after footy training, we would go to a restaurant in Bridge Road, Richmond. There'd be 30 guys, all be single. And after training, we'd all have pasta and bread and tell stories. And we had, we developed this this system, which was called just our own kangaroo court, basically. And I was the judge, and I was the sentencing judge. So what would happen was we'd have our judge, and you would be brought up over dinner on misdemeanors that you did in the nightclub after the game. With our drink cards, and it was an institution in these nightclubs, because there would be six or seven football clubs there. Yeah. Each one of us would get a $50 drink card, which was more than enough for us to drink all night. And the places were packed, and Collingwood had their little section of the Tunnel nightclub. Richmond would have our little section, and we all thought we were the shit hottest blokes on the planet Earth. And we would just look sideways at Collingwood and sideways at St Kilda boys when they came in. And, you know, you'd have a bit of a smile and maybe have a little chat, you know, just to be polite. But you'd have your own. And then all the, you know, these wonderful, wholesome young ladies would come around, and some would always go to the Collingwood boys and some would come to the Richmond boys. And, oh, it was the time of our lives. But we would, you know, we'd stick around there till 3 or 4 in the morning and then go home. And, they were great days. But anyway, we had this kangaroo court every Monday night. We sort of train hard then, and then have this pasta meal, and we would bring up misdemeanors of all different types. And then there was punishments. You know, people would have to wash car windows out the front and ask for donations for charity for people walking past on the footpath. And if they did a bit of public display of affection, they would have to kiss the parking meter out the front for a minute. It's just stuff like that. So they were good days, and they were good times.
So, in the critical role within the club of the judge, how did that follow into the end of season trips? What were your responsibilities through those?
Oh my goodness! So, the end of season footy trips. Most of my footy trips were in Bali, but we went to Mauritius a few times and. Okay, so we would the end of season footy trips were the most outstanding bonding opportunities of all time. I think the modern day footballer, what happened at the end of my career, people were starting to frown upon them, and I'm thinking, I met guys like Gavin Brown wouldn't drink for the whole footy season. He was our fearless and most dedicated and unbelievable captain. He was a magnificent leader. He led from the front. He put his body on the line. He was super disciplined. He was a super hard trainer. But more so like that with Buckley and Paul Williams and the whole footy crew, you know, you dedicate a lot of your commitment to the season, and when it's over, to be able to relax together where nobody knows you in a foreign country where you can let your hair down was the most wonderful balancing of your existence ever. And without it, people get stressed and people get injured, and their mental well-being is not as good. And that was starting to get frowned upon towards the end of my career. And I can just remember just speaking up. I was a bit of a leader at the football club. And I just was encouraging our coaching staff and our administrators, you need to continue this tradition. This tradition is important, it has a value, and it has a place for these young men. And I think you see Dustin Martin and Swanee do their own thing there in Las Vegas for a few years. If players don't have that release, they are not going to play good football the year after. You need to have this balance in lifestyle. So these young guys that are coming in and getting drafted today, and the clubs are putting pressure on them to train all off-season and not have this mental break and this escape, is just completely wrong. Simple as that. They're very valuable, those football trips.
Yeah, which tends to, I mean, being an Asian footy club, luckily, to play a game, we have to go on a footy trip. So that's not...
It's very important, Billy.
I was thinking the same thing, Bill. I was thinking the same thing. Every three months, we're off on one.
Wouldn't balance your life, John.
Yeah, wouldn't mind like an AFL administrator coming along on one, just keeping us out of strife every once in a while. But that's another story.
Now, I am on the AFL Asia board, Billy, so yeah. I could actually raise that.
Yeah, well, it hasn't worked thus far. So, again, walking into a second club, like you mentioned, some people like Gavin Brown, a young Nathan Buckley, and others like Graham Wright, Big Monkey, Tony Francis, Anthony and Sav Rocco. Funnily enough, you might not realise this, but you actually played with two players who went on to play on Anzac Day on the dog track in Vung Tau in Paul Williams. And actually, Richard Osborne came across in one of my first Anzac Day games when we played Hong Kong. So you had two mates who actually went on to play in our Anzac friendship match, which I found kind of incredible. What did you notice between the two clubs? You just spoke very glowingly of Richmond, and then coming into the Collingwood, you know, another obviously very heavily traditional Melbourne footy club. What did you notice between the two clubs, and how did you find the second sort of, I don't know, club of your career?
Well, it was refreshing for me to go to Collingwood because I sort of lost any of the connotations that I was a player who got injured all the time. You have a fresh start and people look at you as a brand new prospect. So to lose all that baggage and go in with a fresh place and to prove myself again was fantastic. They won a grand final. They won the premiership in 1990. I was there now in 1996, and you had the stalwarts, the Monkeys, the Gaffers, the Kellys, the Kerros, Kerrisons. Dermot Brereton did a pre-season with me, but just finished up. He didn't play that next year. But you have you had this success. You had these guys who, Gavin Krasiska, Gavin Brown, you had these guys who had experienced the premiership success, and they were all there. Mickey McGuan.
Yeah.
So you came into this environment where these boys knew how to win, but they also had the Darren Mullane legacy. They were respectful of the vulnerability of life as well. They were terrific men. It was a wonderful footy club to come into. I was lucky enough to bring a lot of the good things at the Richmond Footy Club with these dinners and these kangaroo courts. And I managed to influence the playing group in a fresh way that they weren't used to before. And I was able to bring a lot of that good bonding Richmond culture to Collingwood. And they embraced it. And Buckley and Williams and Scotty Russell and Tony Francis. And I would have guys around for dinner and we would play board games and stuff. So I sort of got to a level, and I was 26 years of age. I got to a leadership level at that footy club pretty quickly, and I was playing consistent senior footy. And Shorey used me magnificently. For whatever reason, my body wasn't able to play a full game, but he put me in the ruck with Monkey, and Monkey would start every quarter, and I'd come on for that 10 or 15 minutes in the middle, and then Monkey would finish. But they would... Monkey and I caused a lot of problems for the opposition ruckman because we're so different, and I was agile and athletic, and I was creating opportunities and running forward and fighting down back, and Monkey was just wearing them out with physicality, and that combination worked well for 3 years with Monkey and I changing the ruck off the bench. So I enjoyed my time there enormously. I ended up becoming really good friends with Paul Williams and Nathan Buckley and the whole crew, and Alex McDonald and Scotty Crow, who came, and Robert Pyman, who came to the footy club with me at the same time. So, you know, and Sav Rocker and Anthony Rocker, you know, they were, it was a terrific footy club. And it was a great environment to come into. And then they had the Anzac Day games. So I'd missed 18 months of football. I got drafted to, I got traded to Collingwood. I just had another operation. And when I walked in, I was on crutches. And sure, he goes, oh, my God, what have we got here? Because I came in on crutches into my first training session. And then maybe 6 weeks later, I was playing in the Anzac Day game. So I got selected from the reserves to play against Fremantle at Victoria Park. I came off the bench and played the second half and picked up 21 possessions in the second half. Wow. And just found my niche in the ruck. Yeah. And got selected for the Anzac Day game the day after, and kicked the goal from 50 after the scores were 1 point the difference for a long time in the last quarter. And that sort of set me up as somebody who was, you know, could contribute to a team, and I managed to have 3 great years there.
So your time, mate, at Collingwood, so your coach, Tony Shaw, the entire time?
Yeah, that's right.
Right, okay. And I guess him as a coach, probably, as I said, as an ex-player that walks in and then as a coach, although he followed Lee Matthews, right? So there was sort of, he retired under Matthews and then must have helped Matt. Did he help Matthews out and then when Matthews left and then got the job? Is that right?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. And I think, we as you say, you touched on the Anzac Day games. Like, and it's funny, we were talking to Ricky Yollerenshaw, you know, a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, and we sort of asked him about the Anzac Day games, and he was doing it quite young, right, when he was playing these Anzac Day games. You're doing it as more of a mature age player, you know, in your mid sort of 20s. What, I guess your first one, you know, the build up, the atmosphere to it. Did Tony Shaw, what did he do for the build up for these games? Did he theme the week? Would he, you know, theme those games? Did he, you know, get you blokes up for the dawn service to get along? Or, you know, can you sort of explain some of the, I guess, the lead up to it, you know, each of these games, because they're very significant in the Victorian landscape or the Australian landscape. And then I guess, you know, any memories you've got from those games.
So the build-ups was absolutely massive. You could never understand what you're going to get yourself in for until you actually run out onto the MCG and line up facing your opposition with the bugle playing, the last post, and a minute's silence. Nothing prepares you for that. And my first Anzac Day game, they had the bugler up on the top of the scoreboard. There was 93,000 there from memory, 93,000 people. It was a big game. It was just a big game. And the build-up and the stories, and it was all about the Anzacs and what they did for our country. And we were just there to pay tribute to them. And we did it representing what men do. You know, you put your body on the line, you make sacrifices. And even though we're just in this little play arena, we didn't underestimate that these guys did it for real. Yeah. And we gave them the respect and we gave the day the respect it deserves. But I remember one of the build-ups, I think Shorey gave me a letter. He made it fairly individual. He gave me a letter that was written by a private in his tent before one of the last offensives in France. And it was just a simple letter. It just said something along the lines of, he was writing a letter home to his wife. Listen, love, we've got this massive offensive tomorrow. I might not come home. I might lose a leg. I might lose my limbs. I might get shot. But it doesn't matter. As long as we achieve what we're setting out to achieve tomorrow, that's all that matters. And it was just the most amazing letter of a bloke who was just willing to understand what was in front of him and accept it and just say, this is what I'm here to do. And it was a bloke by the name of Sergeant Brown that wrote this letter. And I kept it in my footy bag for every single game for the rest of my career. And I just used to read this same letter. And the build-up was phenomenal, you know. The build-up was phenomenal. It's the biggest, it's our national day, you know.
Yeah.
But let me just fast forward to my time at Vungtau. The way that that game was conducted with the vets there and the respect for the Vietnamese military and the respect for the expat, the Australian military and veterans, and the whole day where you see young Vietnamese kids kicking a football on the dog track during the game and getting the footy behind the goals and seeing the wives eat sausage rolls in the grandstands and the game played it with such spirit. And, you know, the same feeling I got at the MCG in front of 93,000 people, I got the same respect and feeling in Vungtau watching you guys take on Cambodia that year. And it was phenomenal. And then the dinner afterwards and the speeches and the recognition and the whole feeling of camaraderie and spirit of peace and love and joy and you're all in it together, and then that community feeling where you go and donate so many good things to the orphanage, from food to money to everything that you've raised during the year. What an amazing experience. And if anybody gets the opportunity to come to Vietnam and experience Anzac Day in Vietnam, my God, it is a unique experience, but it is one of my treasured memories as well, of one of the most special Anzac Days I can commemorate. It was amazing day.
Yeah, funny you say that, because it came up yesterday. I was telling you guys, earlier, I was at my old footy club for a funeral yesterday, and I was sort of talking to a couple of guys who came up from my club and played at the Asian Champs. So it's sort of a bit of a recruiting drive. And we'll talk about, you know, if you get a chance to come back, come around Anzac Day and experience that, because it's quite incredible, as you say. Now, mate, while, just to sort of change tack a little bit, but while you're living my dream, or every schoolboy's dream, roaming around the MCG in front of 90-odd thousand people, free drink cards, women swooning over you, 6'5", just you'd be strutting around in your open neck trousers. Your enigmatic brother is in Vietnam building his own empire in the emerging travel industry. Did you have any idea in terms of what he was up to and sort of the goals he was kicking himself over in Vietnam at the time?
Well, Mikey's story was amazing, because when I finished my AFL footy career, that was basically the same time he came over to Vietnam, and he was going very successfully in Melbourne. He was running, he was only a young fella. He would have only been, you know, late teenagers, early 20s. And he was also running two nightclubs at the Crown Casino complex, and was highly regarded as a terrific hospitality operator already in Melbourne at that stage. So he would have been, 20, early 20s, and he was successful in hospitality in Melbourne. But he just decided, what's that?
More drink cards.
Yeah. He decided to go to Vietnam for a holiday. And he ended up bumping into an expat Australian who said, I want to use your expertise in hospitality over here. And he sent him to a pub in the middle of some mining town out in the middle of the back of Vietnam. And he ran this place called the Spotted Cow, which had Koreans and Vietnamese, and they had machetes and they were fighting, they were miners. And he just tells me the stories where they were brutal. He would have to just lock his staff in the bar, and they were slaughtering each other out the front with machete. And this is 4 hours from any major city. And he was running a pub out there. And then after that, he met a guy by the name of Craig Jackson, who set up pasta restaurants in Vietnam, and very successfully so. And Michael ran, I think, 3 or 4 of those there for a period of time before he went into his own venture with his wife, and he set up the first backpacker hostel in Hanoi. And he didn't have a dime to his name, and he was shaking a placard at the train station at 3 o'clock in the morning when the train came in, just to see if any, and he hired a minivan, and he'd get 6 or 7 people off the train to stay at his hostel, and I would ring him up and say, how many you got tonight? And he'd say, 9. And then he'd tell me, he'd take him upstairs and give him a free beer and cook him a barbecue and then take him on a pub crawl with sombreros on. And he took him out to all these little restaurants and bars, and he would have a good night with them all. But he was a very loving and giving host. He did it for the enjoyment of other people. And by doing that, he just got a reputation where people knew to stay with his hostel, and eventually word of mouth spread and put on this party island in Halong Bay, which put them on the map, on the world map, and the rest is history. He did an amazing job setting up this backpacker hostel chain, and was innovative and entrepreneurial, and he had
amazing.
But we would come across and see him every couple of years, and it was wonderful. You know, he's such a good fella.
So while he was doing that, you're someone who's, you know, run out next to all those incredible names of Australian sport and played on the MCG in front of 100,000 people. And was he starting to bring back a few stories, or on phone calls, or when you'd come out, about having a kick of a footy over here, maybe on the Dead Cat Stadium, and maybe a couple of footy tours and a couple of those early Asian tournaments? What the hell did you think when you heard that, as someone who'd seen footy in its native state, to hear someone telling you like how it can be adopted and you know, taken up anywhere? What were you thinking when you first heard those type of stories?
Well, I used to love them because it was about getting the community together for Michael. Mick just loved getting the community together. So he had this Italian restaurant. He put the footy on. There was no footy anywhere. He'd find the footy on TV and he'd have his mates around to watch beer. And then from there, they started playing and having a kick. And from there, it just grew. But it was all about community. It was about connecting like-minded people together. And then Mike was also amazing in that he was progressive with the Vietnamese culture. He trained them up to become managers, and he trained them up to become, you know, take ownership of businesses. And he was very clever at that. But he also then invited them to come and play this game and enjoy the community that he was creating. And that's how it all started. It was a community-based, let's get together and start. And then there's been some wonderful people who've taken that that impetus and taken to the footy club to where it is now, where it's, we went out to footy training the other day and it's got, 50 or 60 people there all having a kick, and they're from different communities. The Irish community are joining in, and there's a lot of Europeans playing Aussie rules football, and it's well structured and it's well organized, and they're learning skills and they're getting together, but it's still community based. It's still people belonging together, getting fit, having fun, using our game to connect. And then the lunch and the beers after training, you know, that's what it's all about. That it's still there, that spirit, that Australian culture of sport and belonging and community is still there, and that's what makes it successful. But it was amazing to hear his stories over here, and to come over here and see him have a kick, and just enjoy hearing it. And I used to come over here around grand final time a few times, and they would have the big grand final functions, and I would, we'd all get together and watch the grand final in Vietnam. So, you know, it's a wonderful footy culture still over here.
Yeah, true, mate. So true. So then you finished up your pro career playing-wise, and then got coached to move to the Sunshine State, and straight after playing, is that right, and into Redland Footy Club?
So I finished up in 1998. So I stayed in Melbourne and set up a corporate career for 6 years, and then bought my own business and took the family to Queensland and did that for 6 years, and then went back into coaching and just coached community level or state league football. I enjoyed that. Then I left all football altogether and went into school teaching. When I was at school teaching, it's just funny how the world works out. Lee Matthews, who I had a connection with in Brisbane, I used to just catch up with him for coffee and a chat every now and again. Gubby Allen, who was my footy manager at Collingwood, who I still stayed in touch with. Those guys were just talking about Lepich got appointed at the Brisbane Lions as the head coach. They were looking for another development coach, and for whatever reason, there was a number of people who all suggested, well, I've done coaching, I'm just a school teacher, and I'm in Brisbane, and Lepa came around and had a beer, and we had a chat, and he got me back into development coaching. So I was a development coach for 1 year, and I put Steph Martin under my wing. He was battling a lot of issues, mental issues, well-being issues, physical issues, and I just remember I was their ruck coach, and I just used to travel every week with Steph and Matty Leuenberger and Trent West, and I would just work with those guys, and we had a great year. They responded well to my coaching style. I also had all these other abilities, you know, with corporate and small business. So I was headhunted to head up our skill development program thereafter. So the second year I was head of skill development. And then what I did with the skill development program, Greg Swan, the CEO, and the board then appointed me as the general manager of football in my third year. So I went from skill development to head of development to football manager. And I had a year as head of football development, just in charge of all coaches, all players, all administration staff. And we weren't having a lot of success. So I just did identify where we are and where we want to head to, strategic plan. I presented to the board, and we did it from infrastructure to personnel to players. And this program, this strategy, because we knew we were going to finish either bottom or second bottom in my year as football manager, yep. It allowed me to, we had a lot of staff who were very good people, who were very educated and dedicated people, but they'd been at the football club for 20 years, 25, 26 years. And I'm not criticising them, but you get to a stage where a lot of the staff were institutionalised, and the footy club was there and they were there, and it was sort of just nobody was impacting their positions. And so we identified what we wanted, Swanee and I, and we headhunted in April. I went to and had a bottle of wine with the head of medical at the Essendon Football Club, a bloke by the name of Peter Blanche. We had a little bit of toxicity. The players weren't responding well to Lepa. Lepa is a magnificent tactician, but he's not the most warmest human being, let's just say. Yeah. Old school players don't respond to that style. There was a few issues that we had to address. So we needed Swanee and I, we discussed and identified Fagan as an opportunity. We looked at our new head of medical. We had a lot of injuries, and we looked at our physios, and we looked at our high performance program. And over that 12 months, we put together, I changed 36%. So over a third of our football staff. And that would have been close to 25 people, all brand new, all appointed from skill development. We went away from the ex-AFL footballer being a development coach to more of a teaching and football and human human qualities to be our development coaches. So we put this program in place. The problem with the Brisbane Lions was we were getting subsidised by $18 million a year from the AFL. And we were having issues with Lepich and his relationship with the players. And there was a few other issues because I was making all this change to people who'd been there for 25, 26 years. And this guy had gone from skill development manager to head of development to now football manager and making these changes. Yeah. There's a little bit of disgruntlement going along, and people were afraid to ring the AFL. So what happened was the AFL were seeing what was going on. Let me just say the CEO and the board said to me that there was no way that I was going to leave this football club, that what we've done together and worked on was outstanding. But the AFL, because of their power, they were losing a guy by the name of David Noble from Adelaide. He was getting replaced. Right. They didn't want to lose him to the system. they identified him as somebody they could probably put into head office at some stage in his career. So they just made, in their eyes, the very simple decision to replace David Noble and put him in charge of me. I had a chat with David Noble and I just said, what value do you see me having at this football club? He knew they were all my people. He knew that I'd just put them in place. We just spent another $1.5 million on a refurb at the Gabba to upgrade all our facilities. Yeah. I designed the whole complex in a panopticon type of arrangement where it was all open visually, so the power of the head coach could see people working on extras. It changed the culture a little bit of the football club in terms of the transparency of it all. And David Noble came out in the media maybe a month after he'd been appointed saying that he believes that this football club needs stability. It doesn't need any change. And he didn't do anything for 3 years, basically. I'm going to tell you that right now. He just drove and managed, and he's a good operator. There's no doubt about that, but he didn't have to make any massive decisions because it was all done. So that was a great experience. And we drafted the McCluggages and the Berries and these young men that were going to take this footy club forward in that year. These guys were impressive young men at 18.
Yeah.
And it's sort of just there. But Fagan, he's the true genius. Fagan's the true genius. Fagan has this human ability to connect with the players, and the players love him because he's empathetic, he's caring, he's hardworking, he's passionate, he wears his heart on his sleeve, and he's the true genius of that football club, and he deserves all the credit he can possibly get thrown his way, because that's such a powerful position, the head coach, and he's done it magnificently, and it's not easy. He makes it look easy, but that appointment of Fagan to be the head coach of the Brisbane Lions was an outstanding appointment. And let's see how Noble goes. I don't think he has the human ability that Fagan's got. I think he's more of a robot, but let's just see.
Yeah.
They call him the Bible at Brisbane. Very hard to read. And I don't think he could be that as a head coach. I think you need to be very easy to read. Let's see how he goes.
Maybe we can call Billy Playboy. Very easy to read.
Okay.
Gets you excited, does he, Rod?
Not me. He's just very easy to read. He just runs out of fullback, head first, kick goes anywhere. But you know what you're going to get.
With the Lions, what a fascinating insight. What do you think, aside from health, which I guess you know sort of firsthand, and then they've obviously had a few issues, but this year wasn't a bad one. What do you think has stopped them over this past, I think it's three seasons now, where they've genuinely been knocking on the door? At certain stages of those seasons, they've looked like a sure thing to, you know, be the team to beat in September and not got it done. What do you think has caused that?
Well, the reason Brisbane Lions are kicking the door down but not quite getting the chocolates, they're just doing their apprenticeship, man. You got to be knocking the door down for half a dozen years before you take these flags. They don't just come by. I mean, every now and again you get a special group of players like the Baby Bombers and in 2016 the Bulldogs, who can just take everything before them. But that's very rare. Melbourne have been kicking the door down for half a dozen years now. They've got a mature list. And when you look at every position on a premiership team, every single player is probably in the top five or six of his position in the whole competition. So that just takes a while to build. And Brisbane have still got maybe half a dozen spots in their top 24 that are still a fraction fragile. They've got a fantastic list, don't worry, and they're developing all the time. But what I love is that the blokes like Stasevich and the McCartneys and these guys that were fringe players or early players are now becoming in their top five or six in their position for the whole competition. So when you see this development and this growth of a team over the past 4 or 5 years, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
And you know, Eric Hipwood, he's just had a knee reconstruction. He'll come back and he'll become one of the great centre forwards in the competition. Oscar McInerney's got a challenge, you know, he's got to become one of the best ruckmen in the competition. They've still got to recruit really well. They've got to have these young players come up and develop and turn into A-grade players. So I still think, you know, they've got to have to knock on the door for a couple more years before they eventually might win a flag. And then you've got to create these superstars, these one or two Petrakas in your competition, yeah. The Olivers in your team, where you get genuine superstars. And, you know, it was such an important decision for them to keep Lachie Neale, because lose a player like Lachie Neale back to Fremantle and, you know, you go back a couple of years because you need these genuine Brownlow medalists in your team as well to win flags. So they're getting there. They're not far away. And it'd be wonderful to see them win another flag, but they're not easy.
Ain't that the truth? They're hard to win, for sure. Even at any level of sport, right, AFL. Even we took the Asian champs. So now, mate, coming to Vietnam, the big million-dollar question on Billy and I's lips. When did you finally decide to come to Vietnam? And I guess what was the plan then, and what is the plan now?
Well, when I finished at the Brisbane Lions, Mike was in a massive growth part of his business. I used to talk to him and unload and share ideas about what I'm doing with the Lions. He was sharing ideas what he's doing with his backpacking business, and I would grab ideas off him and he would grab ideas off me. And when I finished up at the Lions, he just said, just get over here, come over and work with me. And so he sowed the seed, maybe. And then I eventually said, yeah, let's go, let's do it. So I worked with him before COVID for 3 wonderful years, and we worked pretty closely, and we've got a pretty similar idea about business and management styles and how things work and impact and how to make impacts on business. And we work really well together. In that time, we also set up a couple of businesses where we're importing and distributing wine. And we've also got this little bar here in Saigon that I'm heavily involved with. So we there's some little offshoots to our partnership. And obviously we're continuing to reinvent ourselves and to survive and to get through these difficult times of COVID. So life is always not easy, and it's always taking the ability to be flexible and to be agile and to think outside the square. And so my brother and I are still going on that journey together and sharing ideas most days, and enjoying the challenge of living here and trying to succeed in Vietnam. That's what we're doing.
So you touched on the bar. I know that we're a national club based in two cities and beyond. But both Rocket and I have been permanently based in Saigon during our times in Vietnam. So we've got some kind of blinkers on in that regard. And one thing that's been lacking for the Swans, how could you politely say it? The drinkers, the bar flies, has been a bit of a home base. So the buzz is palpable around Saigon amongst a select group of Swannies. What's happening with the bar? Give it a plug if you can. And what sort of access are the Swans going to be given, given we do like to make ourselves at home?
Well, we've got a lovely little venue. It's got a beautiful beer garden. It's in a great location. It's in Phan Viet Chang. It's right in the heart of some well-established Quay Bar and Birdie Bar precinct. It's unique. It's got a little bit of a Fitzroy / St Kilda feel to it. Nice. For the Melbourne people, it's a bit of a King's Cross feel to it. For the Sydney people, it's a little bit bohemian. It's different, but it's got a nice set of different hospitality venues all along the strip. And we've just set up a absolutely comfortable Vietnamese style bar with Vietnamese prices, 40k beers, 70k wine spritzers, and just a simple bar food menu. And we've got a lovely sports bar, just a simple, beautiful, comfortable spot to watch sport. It has its own beer facilities up there, so our wonderful friends at the Swannies can just help themselves to beers and in a very relaxed style, accumulate their bill quietly over the course of a night watching sport. And there's a lovely beer garden for the girls to drink wine and in a little bit more of a sophisticated atmosphere. And we've got this lovely little bar underneath that's quiet. So the people who like that life, so Rocket might come with his fiance and just sort of look into her eyes and have a nice romantic chat down there in this lovely little romantic setting, which is also there. So it's there to cater for the romantics. It's there to cater for the beer garden. And it's also got a sports bar. So it's a lovely little venue. Obviously, I've had a chat to my brother, who is a legend of the Swannies. We have printed up our little membership cards for the Swannies, 10% off everything, food, drink, wine, whatever you want to spend is 10% off at our bar, which is reciprocal to the Moose and Roo restaurants in Hanoi, which is reciprocal with the Republic in Hanoi and his butcher shop in Hanoi. So it gives a nice little recognition to anybody who's associated with the Swannies to say, hey, you're an important client. This is your home and we're here to look after you. So that's getting printed up at the moment for anybody who becomes a member of the Swannies to be, have these reciprocal cards in Hanoi and Saigon at different venues.
Oh, bring that on.
That's a bloody good plug. Fantastic plug. Righto. Well, having said that, given you've talked about the Swannies so much, Mr. Francis, this leads me into we're nearly at the end of the pod, but my final, how the hell do we get you more involved in the Vietnam Swans? That's now my next question.
Well, it's like anything. I just love being with the energy of the people. I love being associated with the footy club. I'm going to try and get to footy training every couple of weeks. Because I don't play anymore, I can't get out there and have a kick, but I have a role to play, I'm sure. But I think my role's more off-field these days. I think it's probably just to be a good host and to look after the after-training rehydration. But I would love to get down there, and if I have a role with new Vietnamese people who are coming to play and teach them the basics of handballing and kicking, or if there's some other role I can contribute down there, I would love to help out as much as I can. So
I'm sure Tommy Sullivan would welcome you in open arms in terms, as you say, the basics of the game is some of the hardest things to teach people. So, and even if it's the Vietnamese or our women's team. So I'm sure you'd be working with open arms, mate. Now, look, just that we've got two things that we do regularly, mate, on here, and this is basically one's called Rockets Reliables, in brackets, Unreliables. And the other one is Billy's Super Six. Now, you're going to have to think on your feet here a little bit. So, but as you shovel down dinner, down your face there. But basically, one word association from Bill. And I will basically, look, I'm just really just after, if you need someone to kick a goal for your life, who would it be in terms of the people that you'd been involved with? So who would you pick for sure versus who the hell you wouldn't even come close? So for me, Unreliable, Bill. There's no chance of that Bill kicking for goal for me. No chance ever. So because he's rubbish. And probably the grouch for me would be Mr. Reliable. So, but in your career, any guys that spring to mind?
Well, I certainly wouldn't want Duncan Callaway kicking for me. I don't know if you remember a guy called Duncan Callaway. He was effective. He was one of the best footballers I'd ever played with, one of the bravest players I've ever played with. But if he was lining up in front of goal, I don't think I'd want him kicking for my goal. But being a Ballarat boy, being good friends with the late Danny Frawley, if I was going to have anybody kick for goal for me, it's definitely the plugger, Big Tony Lockett. What a charismatic. Oh, yeah. Even when you played against him, you were in awe of the guy. And just to walk find him at the end of a game and just go up and shake his hand, it was just a privilege, you know, to be able to play against him. And what a, probably in my eyes, the greatest footballer that's ever played. So I would love the big plugger kicking for goal for me if my life depended on it. And even if he missed, I wouldn't care. held in that great esteem in my eyes. There was a guy from Collingwood. He was a ruckman. What was his name? Was
James Manson.
Manson.
Wow. Now, Charles Manson. Shocking.
Big Jimmy Manson. I don't think I'd have him kick for goal for me.
No, shocking. He's up there with Bill for sure.
Anyway, to the Super Six. So here we go. I'll give you six words. And, yeah, given the exposure that you've had to all these household names, normally we would use this to throw fellow Swannies under the bus. But if you've got people through your time in footy that that come straight to mind when I give you the words, then we'd love to hear about it. So the first one is just funny. We do normally give people these in advance so they can have a bit of a thought coming up. Sorry, mate, we're throwing you on the bus just to finish off the pod. But yeah, who was some funny characters you come across?
Brian Lees was probably one of the funniest blokes.
Brian Lees, the boy from Trafalgar.
Yeah, he was a funny fella. He lived life according to his own rules. Hilarious guy. And he was hilarious to go out with.
Out of curiosity, what was his nickname at Richmond? Was Pizza ring a bell?
Pizza? No, I didn't call him Pizza.
I used to call him Pizza at Trafalgar because he had bad acne.
No, he was a bit of a he thought he was a bit of a pretty boy at Richmond, so he didn't have the acne when he came with us.
Yeah, right, okay.
Lazy. I think we called him Lazy.
So the second one, angry.
Angry.
Geez, you played for a couple of clubs, and especially you could say the Victoria Park members. They're always pretty bloody angry.
Tony Free was an angry little fella. Tony Free, you wouldn't want to mess with him when he was angry. He was pound for pound probably one of the toughest in the game. He didn't take a backward step to anybody, including Dermot Brera and these boys. He was one of my captains. Yeah. Flea was pretty angry. You don't want to mess with Flea either. He would throw a few if it warranted it.
All right. Now you mentioned before that you you embraced some of the off field aspects of being at footy clubs. Who was the best dressed amongst your compatriots?
Maybe Desi Ryan. Desi Ryan was always pretty special with his style. Brian Lees, he always put a lot of effort into his outfits as well. Alan McCullough used to always bring a little bit of a surfy nature to it. I'd say probably Desi Ryan was the number one Gucci boy at Richmond when I was there.
Okay. I noticed here, mate, you're picking all the Richmond boys and no one at Collingwood, so I don't know if that says anything.
Well, a few too many South Australians at Collingwood, so their fashion sense was pretty plain, let me tell you.
That's going to go down well amongst the Swans boys.
Let me go through a few. Mickey Gaffer, do you think he was fashionable? Scotty Russell, Tony Francis, they were not fashionable boys. They were a bit awkward looking. Big Monkey, you know, I wouldn't put him down as a fashionista.
To this day.
Yeah. Big unit.
No, there wasn't too many fashionable guys at Collingwood. Probably got too much influence from our supporters.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Now, was there any players, given you mentioned the difference that you could see in some of the stars and the effort that they actually put in preparation and how that took them, was there anyone who got by on sheer talent that, when I say the word lazy, comes to mind?
In my era, it found you out. There was no lazy players who made it in my experience at Richmond and Collingwood when I was there. Anybody who was lazy didn't make it.
Yep. What about the coach's pet at either of the clubs? Or there might be a few.
In terms of coach's pet, I'm going to have to put myself in that bracket under John Northey. For whatever reason, John Northey used to always just play me and I was very fortunate to have his trust.
Yep.
So, but he made everybody feel like that they were his favourite. So he had this wonderful ability. And if you asked any Richmond player during that period, they probably also, yeah, I was John Norley's favourite player. So that's that was the beautiful, unique nature of John Norley as a coach, I think. But obviously, sure, he had a pretty close affinity with Bucks.
Yep.
They were pretty tight. I don't think Shorey had any other pets, as far as I'm aware.
Yep, the final of the Super Six is annoying. Now, this can be an endearing annoying or an outright pest annoying. Both.
Robbie Pyman was very annoying. Scotty Crow was very annoying. These boys just got enjoyment out of Robbie Pyman in particular just got enjoyment out of just making life miserable for you if you could.
So on that note, we'll I must say this has been one of the more incredible hours of content that we've pulled together for this podcast. Like I said at the start, this is our 16th episode, and I think we've nailed a ripper. So to you, Rocket, I know it's way, way, way past your bedtime. I also noticed that your relationship status might have been broadcast, whether you liked it or not, during that. So congratulations on that. Thank you very much for your effort tonight, Rocket.
Pleasure, Bill, as always. And, Matty, Bill will give you a wrap, but good to see you, and thanks for joining us.
And say good day to your boyfriend for me.
Boom. Boom.
Going out swinging. So, once again, Matty, thank you so much for your time. It's been absolutely fantastic for us to hear, and I'm sure a lot of the Swannies family are going to absolutely love picking through this. I'm glad you were able to take a few swings on the way through. It always makes things exciting. I enjoy a bit of controversy. And we just can't wait to get into Bintan and into the new venue in the next couple of weeks. We start with the AGM this weekend and then go from there. So, Matty, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Billy. Thanks for having me, mate. It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Robert.
As we get excited about watching some footy in Matty's new bar, it's important to keep supporting all of our 2021 sponsors. They've been incredible throughout the year, and we need the Swannies family to get behind them in any way you can. Our 2021 sponsors are Halida Beer, Mickey Francis's incredible venue for sport and dining up in Hanoi, the Republic, the Alfrescos Group, HMS Host International, in particular the Burger King restaurants in airports throughout Vietnam, Wildside Custom, TAL Apparel. Also thanks to some of our long-time sponsors and supporters in Crown Relocations, QBE, AIS, X Digital, Ninja Inc. As always, we hope you've enjoyed the podcast. Please subscribe to catch future episodes or check out some of our previous ones. And make sure you follow the Swans on Facebook and on the website to keep up with the latest footy in Vietnam news. And as always, keep honking.